Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, huge wins in New Hampshire for Trump and Sanders. Markets roiling. The Oregon standoff comes to an end. Billionaire Donald Trump won big in the first in the nation primary.
Thank you, New Hampshire, thank you. We are going now to South Carolina.
Bernie Sanders won big, too, with ecstatic supporters, said last night in debate with Hillary Clinton in Milwaukee that there is more than one way to make history this election season.
Somebody with my background, somebody with my views, somebody who has spent his entire life taking on the big money interest. I think a Sanders victory would be of some historical accomplishment as well.
And the standoff in Oregon is over after 40 days. Julie Weichel lives near the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, said she's glad it's over.
I have never been a fearful person. I live out here with rattlesnakes and howling coyotes, and I have never been afraid until these yahoos showed up.
Until these yahoos showed up. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Christina Bellantoni of the Los Angeles Times, Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Could it really be Trump and Sanders all the way? And what is going on Wall Street? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. At On Point Radio, joining us now from Los Angeles, Christina Bellantoni, Assistant Managing Editor for Politics at the LA Times, former Editor-in-Chief of Roll Call. Christina, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. What a week.
Yeah, what a week. Oh, my gosh. And from Washington, Sudeep Reddy is with us, Deputy Global Economics Editor at the Wall Street Journal. Sudeep, great to have you here as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Christina, and Sudeep.
Folks, there is nothing to worry about, Donald Trump told everybody at his victory party on Tuesday night.
So we're going to take care of the economy. We're going to take care of jobs. We're going to take care of all of the things that I said. Our border, everything, healthcare, it's going to be so great.
And Bernie Sanders, whoever thought this could have happened just 9 months ago, he said.
9 months ago, we began our campaign here in New Hampshire. We had no campaign organization, we had no money, and we were taking on the most powerful political organization in the United States of America.
By which I guess he means the Clinton campaign. Christina Bellantoni in L.A., be honest, 9 months, 1 year ago, would the political, analytical class in this country ever have foreseen this outcome in New Hampshire?
So I'm stealing this from Dave Weigel of The Washington Post, but he tweeted when the New Hampshire Union Leader came out and it showed Sanders and Trump as the victors the next morning. He said, it's as if a time traveler stepped on a butterfly somewhere. And that's a little bit how I feel. I mean, it's a great moment to be a political journalist because this is interesting. I remember very clearly a year ago, as you ask, political journalists were talking about how boring it was going to be covering another Clinton-Bush race and oh boo-hoo. And really, look, it's the exact opposite of what's happening. I think that it's good for democracy when people pay attention to politics for this long. You could argue that it might be good for either party. In 2008, you saw that the Democrats, they played out in every single contest in every single state and territory, and registration of all voters went up. And that's something that, if this does go on, California's June 7th primary could end up being influential. I mean, it's very early to be able to say that. Mitt Romney.
But it's amazing to think that all the way that far down the line, it may still be in play.
And nothing is impossible. And just to point out, Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum did not resolve their standoff until April. So I think we've got a little ways to go. But it is completely surprising. And what a country.
Sudeep, I mean, you're an economics guy here. We're going to look at the markets. But look at this race for a minute and the claims and the rallying cry from these two winners. Donald Trump, I can fix it. I will fix it. Bernie Sanders, I am going to turn it upside down. How's Wall Street looking at these two? Do they buy Trump's claim at all? Is anything to do in the markets to do with Bernie's win?
Wall Street is probably looking at this a little befuddled, trying to figure out what on earth is happening here. All of the existing conventions, the order that people expected from the Democratic Party, from the Republican Party, a lot of that is being turned upside down. What we have here is actually really good for democracy. We have two leading candidates, and the leading candidates on both sides, who are actually presenting very, very different visions for America. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump probably don't agree on much, but they agree that the existing economic and political order is not working for the country. And that's what they're tapping into. And it's giving voters out there, not just in New Hampshire and Iowa, but everywhere, a chance to really see what the world might look like with single-payer health care or with a fundamentally different immigration system and norms of what we think of as people coming into the country from Donald Trump. All of these ideas are being thrown out there. They don't have a lot of details around them in every case, but at least the ideas are out there and forcing people to think about what they want the country to be.
Jack, it is definitely very exciting. Good for democracy, maybe, to shake out the covers and shake out the cobwebs. You know, though, Jack, that there are plenty mainstream Republicans and mainstream Democrats saying this is a recipe for disaster here. Donald Trump, a lot of Republicans afraid, A, that he can't win, or B, that if he does, that he'll go way off of their sort of Republican orthodoxy. Democrats, same fears among mainstream, maybe Clinton supporters, that in the end, Bernie won't pull this out. And if he did, what would that mean?
It would mean something totally unprecedented. I think he spoke to it last night in the bit we quoted. It would be a unique situation to have a Democratic socialist on the Democratic ticket. But, you know, Bernie Trump has something going for him, and that really is one of the lessons.
Bernie Trump, Bernie Sanders.
There you go.
They haven't merged yet.
Yeah, there you go. You know, message beats no message. You know, if you ask him, why are you running for president, Senator? I'm running to combat economic inequality, to secure the planet against climate change, and to end the corruption of American politics by moneyed interest. Why are you running, Secretary Clinton? If you know the answer, call her Brooklyn headquarters. They're desperately seeking a message. In 2008, remember, it was, I'm in it to win it. This year, Ruth Marcus called Clinton's gauzy announcement video insultingly vapid. You know, if you're running for president, it helps to be able to say why.
What about the Trump victory here, Jack? The significance? I mean, it's not over in the GOP. You've got Cruz and you've got Rubio and more still hoping, and mainstream Republicans behind them hoping Trump fumbles and one of them steps up. What do you see?
Well, you know, I don't see, let's put it this way. David Frum calls his victory in New Hampshire a triumph of democracy because it represents what you're saying, the politics of insurgent protest against an ossified, out-of-touch GOP establishment. That's the positive side. On the negative side, it's kind of a disturbing phenomenon. You know, he's exposed, Trump's rise has exposed a crack in our system, the ratings hunger that drives cable news, and through it, he's really injected extremism into the body politic. In that sense, his New Hampshire victory reveals a newly vulnerable democracy.
I mean, I was in New Hampshire. Of course, you were too, Jack, at a Trump rally. You know, a lot of his sentences sort of filter off into nothingness or ellipses that hang in the air. But he was talking to the crowd, roaring crowd, about, you know, how we're going to deal with all the things we don't like to see. And it had a little bit of, we're going to get rid of those people, or the, I don't know, there is definitely an angry edge on it. We'll hear from our listeners, Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, esteemed guest. Bernie is in it to win it. He's not in there to pull somebody to the left, although Democratic Party obviously needs that after being yanked to the right for 35 years. So having volunteered for Bernie in Burlington, Vermont, when I was putting a girlfriend through school there, voted for him twice, watched him win that first election by 10 votes. When he says don't underestimate him, that's good advice.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly feeling it. He's clearly on a roll. And those that army of supporters out there, way out in the boonies in New Hampshire, the deepest reaches of the state, we heard from this week, where they had had their door knocked on. Appreciate that, Ken. One more right here. Matthew, Quincy, Massachusetts. Matthew, you're on.
Yeah, I saw the debate last night, and I thought Hillary took it. I thought she was very strong on foreign policy. She gave detailed answers as to how she's going to do it. I like Bernie, but Bernie does not tell the voters how he's going to accomplish all those great promises. That will require tax increases. How he's going to get that through a Republican Congress, he won't tell us. He'll go back to a stump speech about what he believes in, income inequality. And my question to Jack is, if you're running for president, shouldn't you tell the voters exactly how you're going to complete all those great promises that you're saying you will do when you are president? He doesn't tell us.
Sir Jack, what do you say?
Well, you know, Bernie does it through a sort of secret sauce. I'm going to mobilize a political revolution that's going to sweep away the GOP Congress, and that will do it. You know, but, you know, the numbers don't support that candidacy justifying claim on net that he can mobilize new voters. Consider, in Iowa, Democratic turnout was down 22% from 2008. GOP turnout up 54% in New Hampshire, the same picture. Democrats down 50,000 votes, Republicans up 30,000. Sorry, Bernie, it's Trump who's mobilizing new voters.
Christina, is the how a stumbling block for Bernie Sanders? I mean, Hillary Clinton really banging on that at the debate in Milwaukee last night.
That's what she really attempted to hit home. And if you noted, she did this very pointed aside, you know, talking about the reality of getting things done as president, which she can refer to, you know, her husband's, you know, presidency, but also her time as Secretary of State and working with an administration. But she pointedly added this, especially young people need to understand this, right? Because one of the things that Sanders gets a lot of attention for is talking about, you know, free college and helping with student loan debt. And that's where she's losing these voters. And the millennials are a bit of a problem for her, but she's going at that competency argument as often as she can and that she can work with Congress.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump and Sanders take New Hampshire, a rocky week on Wall Street. An end to the standoff in Oregon. Hope and bombs, lots of bombs still in Syria. Christina Bellantoni is with us from the Los Angeles Times. Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What about the Trump and Sanders wins? Can they go all the way? Could you see that? Are you starting to sweat over Wall Street's swoon? What do you see driving global markets down? Somebody call us. Your Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Cliff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Yes, I just wanted to say that Trump and Hillary and many of the others are a representation of what the 1% are all about and the ones that have been dragging us down for the longest time. I'm all for Bernie because he has been tapping people on the shoulder and saying, hey, these are the people that you need to avoid if you don't want to be living the way you have been living. You haven't been living very well for the past 35 years. Well, these are the guys, these are the people that are reason why you haven't been living quite as well.
Cliff, we've got it, and we hear that again and again, a kind of karmic bill to be paid for all those years of mounting inequality. On the other hand, Trump is pulling people out, and I talked with him last week in New Hampshire, who said he can do it. He's a smart businessman. That's what we need, a businessman to run the country. Bernie, a big response as well, though. One more right here, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Adam, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I listen to the show every day. I'm a huge fan. So I'm a millennial, and I'm actually fed up with my fellow millennials and the overwhelming disdain for Hillary Clinton. I'm actually horrified at how the Sanders campaign is being run. I'm in disbelief that so many are eating up an empty economic plan. I am angered by the relentless dismissal of Hillary's lengthy experience, which includes a strong record of defending the middle class. And after last night's debate, where I watched Sanders declare he would make racial issues better than Barack Obama could,
and wagged his finger at Hillary Clinton left and right, I found myself at a further loss for how so many could be supporting this empty candidate.
Empty candidate. Watch out, Adam. Watch out. Your peers in age may be on your case about that. But let's listen to some of that from last night. It's true. Hillary raised the how are you going to do it? Do the numbers add up argument here. Let's hear that. And Sanders' reply here, Clinton took aim at Sanders' health care plan, suggesting not realistic.
Last week in a CNN town hall, the senator told a questioner that the questioner would spend about $500 in taxes to get about $5,000 in health care. Every progressive economist who has analyzed that says that the numbers don't add up. And that's a promise that cannot be kept.
Sanders fired straight back, said, hey, wait a minute, sure they can.
Millions of people have high deductibles and copayments. What I said, and let me repeat it, I don't know what economist Secretary Clinton is talking to, but what I have said, and let me repeat it, that yes, the family right in the middle of the economy would pay $500 more in taxes and get a reduction in their health care costs of $5,000.
I don't know who to take these numbers to. I mean, you always get into deep water in a hurry. But Sudeep, when you look broadly at the Sanders plan and promises, do you see a tax and spend framework that adds up?
Bernie Sanders has actually been very open about the fact that he would raise taxes. He would raise taxes particularly on the very, very wealthy to pay for this. And he is not hiding that at all. Whether the numbers add up is an important question, but I don't really think the numbers are adding up for most of the candidates who are out there. For the Sanders argument, it's not really adding up. For the Donald Trump argument, we actually aren't seeing a whole lot of numbers. And when numbers are presented, they're not adding up. Same thing for a lot of the other candidates, including Ted Cruz. The Hillary Clinton argument is more of a slow and steady progress kind of argument to say, look at where we've come over the Obama years. We'll make some steady gains. But even there, the argument doesn't really hold up that if you continue on the same path, we will actually see significant improvement for rank and file workers, for people who have been left behind by this recovery. That is one of the failures that we've seen over the last few years is the gains have gone to the wealthy largely because of gains in the stock market and not to rank and file workers.
Christina, how does this play for Hillary Clinton? I mean, she seems to be trying in response to Sanders' big showing to be at the same time about realism and to be aspirational, more idealistic, to appeal to that sector that clearly wants big change here. How's that combo work for her?
Well, what's so interesting to me is the role that President Obama is playing in this. You saw that very last exchange between Clinton and Sanders last night was all about who stood closer to President Obama. You know, Hillary Clinton accused Sanders of saying that the president wasn't progressive and, you know, hadn't gone far enough and was disappointing. And some Obama loyalists who are apparently supporting Hillary Clinton, including David Plouffe, the former campaign manager for Team Obama, actually put out a copy of Bill Press, a radio host, had a book called something like, you know, Why Obama Has Disappointed Progressives and How He Hasn't Done What He Wants. And right on the top of the book cover is an endorsement from Senator Sanders. Mm. And that's something that you're going to hear again and again. But it's also going to start to get to be an argument about process. And voters don't love that. But you're going to hear the Clinton camp talk about delegates. They're, you know, going to be roughly split in delegates over in the next few weeks until we get to Super Tuesday. And then does she win in some of those bigger states because she's better known? Or is Sanders able to really capitalize on all of the new attention that he's getting? This could really stay a split contest for a long time, which means the way she has to win is to go negative. And we're hearing reports on Friday that she is going to have the super PAC that supports her is going to start going really negative on Senator Sanders. So, you know, what those end up looking like are those ads that say, you know, what are you going to do when it's 3 a.m., right? Like her attacks against then Senator Obama in 2008. Or are they going to make this, you know, you're just living in the clouds? Because voters, particularly liberal Democratic voters, like idealism. They've proven that again and again in their choices that they've made.
Yeah. At the same time, you can see Sanders going to town if he's attacked by a super PAC, the thing he probably does not have. He likes to see. Mike in Buffalo, New York. Mike, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to offer a bit of a counterpoint as millennial to the previous caller, Adam. And what I see as the Hillary Clinton campaign is really telling us as millennials is that we should kind of leave our naivety and destroy our political imaginations. And I really feel as though the tone from her campaign is condescending towards young people. And that sort of tone is really helpful considering the enormous age gap that exists.
Wow. Jack Beatty, Hillary trying to destroy the political imagination of a generation.
Boy, what a statement. That is just so eloquent. Well, you know, I guess her people would say, but wait a minute. If the imagination is feeding on fantasy, shouldn't a candidate try to say to people, folks, here's what is possible in the world, and it isn't so bad. You know, we can, what does Hillary say? We can make progress. But, you know, you raised, Tom, the question of, you know, the numbers on Bernie's plan. Well, there was a committee for the Responsible Federal Budget ran the numbers recently, and they found that he's several trillion short. Several trillion of covering expenses, and that the only way to sort of make all this work would be to raise the top marginal rate on the rich to 85%, which is north of the point that even, you know, Thomas Piketty.
So Eisenhower was up there for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was at 91. Yeah. But that was, of course, in a different world where capital was much less mobile and the rich much less mobile.
Yeah.
So these things are starting to come in, and you know, you could say, well, that's deflating my political imagination. Maybe it's acquainting it with what's possible.
Dave in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. So I got a lot of respect for Bernie Sanders and his message and his supporters, but I see a real irony in the movement. And that said, it seems to have grown out of, a response to the Great Recession. But that, along with a whole bunch of other disasters, you know, happened because Bush, was president. And Bush was president, you know, because he got appointed by Scalia due to a very close election in 2000.
On the Florida results, yeah.
Yeah, and one reason it was so close was because the left didn't like Gore. You know, he wasn't the guy they wanted, so a lot of them went with Nader. And they, you know, people said a vote for Nader, is a vote for Bush, but they're like, no, it doesn't matter. Well, I would submit that it really did matter. You know, there was a lot not to like about Gore, but man, compared to Bush. And so, you know, if Bernie can win nationally, that's great. But if he can't and he gets, you know, the nomination and he loses, like, you know, a lot of that destruction, the end of the health care reform and on, that's going to be on a lot of these Sanders supporters. So, you know, you got to be really smart here about the choice. Even if you don't like Hillary that much, like, stakes are really high.
Dave, I appreciate your call. Christina, there's no question for those going with Sanders. This is a big bet on political imagination.
It is. But, you know, think about this, particularly with young voters. The first-time voters of this year were not alive during Bill Clinton's first term. So they have a completely different understanding of Hillary Clinton than we do, having experienced her, you know, coming up as the governor's wife in Arkansas, as first lady, how she was able to claw her way through that, you know, race in 2008 and stay until the very end and then become the president's secretary of state as a partner. You know, they're only looking at her in this short-term prism. So, you know, Sanders supporters look at him as someone who can speak to them as somebody who has been fighting forever. He says exactly the types of things they want to hear. And that reality of how can it get done, somehow people forget that Washington is fairly gridlocked. It's not actually at its most gridlocked ever. We've seen some compromises over the last year or two, particularly on budget issues. But somehow they're forgetting the whole Congress part. And this is where somebody brought up a very interesting point to me about Donald Trump. Let's just say he were to become president. Congress is going to completely reject that kind of outsiderism, right? And somehow you're going to have to see Republicans and Democrats work together in Congress to get around the person in the White House. Clearly a lot of speculation, but that's
not that much. I mean, people are envisioning right now. We've got callers on exactly that front. Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama. Ronnie, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. You know, the people are saying that they're tired of the Washington establishment. When I hear that, it's not the presidency alone, it's Congress. You know, unless there's a change in Congress, you know, that's the establishment. But I'm not hearing anything about Congress, or is Congress pretty much set, well, we're secure because of the way the congressional districts are drawn right now, that they're not worried. And I'm not hearing anything about the uproar over Congress. I mean, Donald Duck could be the president. And unless Congress works with him, it's not going to work. And it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat president, are they going to have to rule by executive order?
And we're seeing something of potentially the limits to that this week from the Supreme Court. Ronnie, thanks. One more. Diane, Summertown, Tennessee. You're on, Diane.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, look how far Obama got and how hard it was for him. I think people need to be realistic. And Bernie's 74 years old, you know, and also foreign policy. You know, I mean, I think that's really important. And I think Hillary has got that way ahead of anybody that's running. And I think that she will keep us safe. I think she's smart. And I think she's got what it takes.
Resonating there with the Clinton message on realism and experience. Diane, thanks for that. One more. Algoma, Wisconsin. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I guess my point goes back to what the previous caller had said is, you know, if Congress isn't willing to work with the president, then we're going to have the same thing. Voters need to be smart when they're doing this. There are a lot of things I trust more than Hillary Clinton. I trust Mexican tap water more than I trust.
We got some phrase makers today.
I'm 30 years old, Tom, and I came up through this last recession, and I have not seen anything that works for me coming from the government. Now, on national security, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State for Obama's first term, correct? So We have terrible relations with the rest of the world. There isn't a single country out there that likes us. Democratic socialism works. Look at Europe. Look at the Scandinavian countries. Look at Denmark. Look at Germany. Those are some of the strongest economies in the world right now, and they have the happiest people per capita.
Jason, we've got it. You're ready to roll. I mean, there are people ready to just roll it back and others just marveling at this. David Brooks in the New York Times looking at this today, you know, saying, wait a minute, we had this consensus around American-style capitalism, individualism, achievement, flexibility. And now he says, it's amazing, he writes, that a large part of the millennial generation has rejected this consensus. Yeah, we're talking big change here. But if it's all about executive authority, Jack, I mean, this week the Supreme Court, and on a very important step, the Clean Power Plan from the Obama administration, the heart of what was presented in Paris as the American contribution to cutting down on climate change, and the court saying, wait a minute, hold, put a stay on that plan while we think about it, and we may very well knock that down over overreach on executive authority.
Yeah, Tom, and 29 states are suing to block the EPA from moving against those coal-fired power plants. And, you know, the states' rights argument they made, according to the SCOTUS blog, quote, probably attracted the support of Justice Kennedy, a champion of the dignity of state governments. Also before the court is Obama's executive order on undocumented immigrants that would protect, I don't know, 5 million from deportation. Now, last month, the court asked lawyers on both sides to prepare briefs on the Constitution's take care clause, as in the president shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Court watchers look at that and they see signs that this court is itching for what Richard Posner calls a showdown with executive powers, leaving the question that President Obama may bequeath a shrunken presidency to his successors.
We will watch that with great, great interest. So much hinging on it, perhaps even the Paris Agreement itself. The issue of who's coming into this country on the Republican side. Donald Trump, of course, wall, build a wall. Interesting, we heard Jeb Bush on Morning Joe on Wednesday condemning that kind of talk. Here's Jeb Bush.
This is a horrific idea, and it sends this signal of divisiveness at a time when we need to find things that unite us. Our country has fallen apart, and we don't need presidents, candidates on the left or right that continue to prey on that division.
64% of New Hampshire Republicans supporting a ban on Muslims entering the U.S., and Jeb Bush pushing back very explicitly on that, Jack.
Yeah, you know, good for Jeb Bush. I mean, I saw him up here in Hanover, and he said, you know, I'm the only one who's taken on Trump. And it's true. In the debates he did, he was pretty much the only one to take on Trump. And it's just refreshing to hear that kind of political courage, because that's directly in the face of the sentiment you just mentioned, Tom, that a majority of Republicans in New Hampshire, at least, wanted to exclude Muslims. That takes courage.
Christina, Republicans field still a wide open race here. I mean, Trump's got New Hampshire, but you got Cruz and Moore still gunning for him.
You sure do. This is really fun to think about. It's kind of a question of math. I mean, yes, political process can be boring, but this is a long way to go for them. You've got the South, where Ted Cruz is probably going to do well, although Donald Trump is best positioned and best known and still remains the national frontrunner. What does Marco Rubio do? And somehow Jeb Bush is still in there spending all of his efforts attacking Marco Rubio.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Carnival celebrations rolled on in Brazil despite fears of the Zika virus. The BBC spoke with a pregnant woman out on the streets of Rio.
We are very afraid, very concerned, but we cannot stop life. So, and it's Carnival, it's Rio, Brazil, we have to go out.
Yeah, a major scientific announcement yesterday. The first actual detection of gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space, time. They sound here like a chirp. And a different kind of music. Beyonce took the field for the Super Bowl halftime show Sunday. Her new song, Formation, went straight at Black identity. Halftime at the Super Bowl in full regalia, kind of a nod back to Michael Jackson there by Beyonce. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump and Sanders, a rocky week on Wall Street, an end to the standoff in Oregon, hope, and lots of bombs in Syria. Sudeep Reddy is with us, Deputy Global Economics Editor at the Wall Street Journal. Christina Bellantoni with us from the Los Angeles Times, editing politics there. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What do you see driving global markets down? Did you listen to the president this week in Springfield? Did you feel nostalgia for the lost promise of a national kumbaya under Obama? And does this ceasefire talk over Syria give you hope or stoke your skepticism? What about Oregon? What about the Justice Department on Ferguson? What about the Supreme Court on the Clean Power Plan, putting a stay on the president's climate change fight this week? Sudeep, these down and down and down numbers on Wall Street and elsewhere starting to get a lot of people's attention. I know Wall Street's been watching for a while now. What is going on, Sudeep?
Well, we have seen the worst start to the year for the U.S. stock market in history, which is a remarkable feat.
In history.
We've never actually seen a drop of this size at the start of the year.
What size is it?
We're looking about 15% from the peak of where the stock market was. It's not quite that much over the last month. Globally, though, stock markets around the world are collectively down about 20% from their peak. So that means global stocks have entered a bear market in stock market parlance. What investors are really seeing is they're growing a little panicky about whether the world is headed for another downturn. They're worried about China. We don't really know how bad the Chinese economy is. It's slowing. It's not clear whether it's slowing faster than the Chinese say it's slowing. We're seeing a lot of worrisome signals in oil. We've seen the price of oil drop to a new 13-year low this week, and cheap oil is supposed to be good for the U.S. economy and good for consumers generally. It hasn't proven to be quite that good so far, and it could be sending some bad signals as well, that maybe demand is not as strong as we had hoped around the world. And there's a fair amount of panicking about policymakers. If you look back to where we've come from 8 years ago when the economic downturn started in the United States, you saw the rescue brigade come up. You saw central bankers show up. You saw stimulus in the form of tax breaks in the big stimulus program that injected money into the economy. Now investors are getting a little worried that the global economy might have a heart attack and the ambulance won't arrive. And they're wondering what would that world look like. There's a bit of a sky is falling mentality around all of this. It's probably overdone, but all of that adds up to a fair amount of nervousness, and it's going to take a bit of a jolt from policymakers to come in and make everyone aware they haven't left the room. They're still there to provide some support, but it's a balancing act that they're working through.
I mean, sky is falling, maybe, but I mean, the word downturn doesn't really seem to be adequate for what we saw last time. the Great Recession, we've finally come to call it. I mean, it was big, and we're told again and again we were on the edge of a mighty cliff there. I guess this always happens in downturns, but it's not the old, okay, we go up, we go down, but everything's fine mentality behind all this. There's a kind of collapse fear that you can sense out there, Sudeep.
There is, and there's an incredible amount of anxiety that's left over from the last crisis. Usually we come out of economic downturns faster than we have. We usually see wage growth gains go across the spectrum faster than we have in this recovery. The one area that we saw the recovery occur much faster was obviously in the stock market, and that has actually exacerbated the income inequality trends that had been taking shape for decades. And of course, that has injected itself right back into the political machinery and created even more angst. So you've got the forces of economics, the forces of markets, and the forces of politics all colliding here and making people wonder what's going to be around the corner.
And you say back in policymakers' laps, but who is that exactly? Congress has been kind of out to lunch on this. We had Janet Yellen, of course, the Fed and other central banks have done a lot. In some ways, they've been the only ones acting here for a while now. She was testifying this week on Capitol Hill, responding to a question about whether she'd hold off on increasing interest rates because of turmoil in stock markets.
I think the answer is maybe, but the jury is out. We've continued to see progress in the labor market over the last 3 months.
Of course, if things get bumpy, they don't have quite the same ammo that they had last time. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just was reading an article by Sue Ducklow from the All News Pipeline. She says that the central banks are rigging the market. And on that Monday, there was a 1,000-point plunge. And then it went back up to 500. And then she said there was 4,500 crash events. And the trading was halted and resumed. But we're going down the same path as China. You know, when they tried to cover, you know, it from plunging like this.
Central banks, John. Thanks for calling, Sudeep. What about them? We heard Mohammed Alarian, big figure in the finance world, saying today, you know, Congress and at other legislators, but especially here in the U.S., have left it all on the Fed to deal with this, or so much of it, and that's not going to work anymore. What about the Fed's ammo and influence if we get in more trouble?
It's not going to work. He calls it the only game in town, and it's been true for several years. We are not seeing our political system deliver the kinds of actual underlying economic changes that we need. We talk about coming up with a tax system that's better for growth in the country, an immigration system, an education system, a better worker training system. None of that is happening in a meaningful way through Congress, and the U.S. is not alone on that front. If you look around the world, politicians, elected officials are failing everywhere to come up with fundamental changes to their economies. And as a result, they're leaning on central bankers who have the independent ability to print money, to keep interest rates low, to provide temporary jolts. But you can only provide a temporary jolt for so long, and eventually you're going to have to have something else supporting an economy. So Janet Yellen actually had the luxury of being the first who actually had economic conditions to allow an exit from that extraordinary policy. The U.S. economy, even though it's obviously not great, it's better than almost any economy, certainly any advanced economy around the world. And she was trying to be the first to lead the world into a much better situation where they'd be prepared for the next downturn. She's obviously struggling on that front. The economy is not cooperating, and it seems very likely, given conditions where they are now, she's going to have to pause in raising interest rates after only having brought them up a quarter of a percentage point from zero.
I mean, you have a Congress sort of diddling and posturing and fighting for a long, long time, really not doing much. You expect that doesn't have consequences over time? Maybe it does. Maybe they're here. Richard in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I can understand that there's a lot of reason for frustration with Washington. But remember, we are the voters that send more and more extreme people each election cycle, and then we wonder why things don't get done. If we want to do something truly radical, we should send someone who can survive the nominating process, acknowledging at least a little bit of merit to what the opponent, what their opponents say, but work with them.
Yeah, point taken. And it was a point that this week President Obama was making. It was 9 years since he announced his candidacy for the presidency in Springfield, Illinois, and he was back talking about America's broken political system.
The ease with which we're distracted by the petty and trivial, our chronic avoidance of tough decisions,
our preference for scoring cheap political points instead of rolling up our sleeves and building a working consensus to tackle the big problems of America.
Christina, here we go off into the economy, and it loops back to politics, whether it's Mohammed El-Aryan looking at this or Sudeep Reddy, or the candidacies that are out there, you know, with Trump saying we can't do it the way the GOP and everybody else has been doing it, Sanders saying we can't do it the way anybody's been doing it. But, you know, is there a bigger change afoot here that could actually lead to a different congressional profile that would roll up its sleeves, as the president says, and get in there and fix things?
Well, that's a lot of questions. I will sort of start that with a question about Obama. We had an exclusive sit-down interview with him that's on the front page of the Los Angeles Times today that looks at not just that partisanship idea, but should he have spent more time with Congress, right? The congressional relations, Bill Clinton was very good at it. George W. Bush was not great at it, but had his moments where he was able to achieve things. And President Obama has not been good at it. And that's one reason you're seeing such sort of stymied and intense feelings. And this does play into all of it, what you can get done in America, how the government functions. And you really heard Hillary Clinton say at the debate that she is not just running effectively as an Obama third term, you know, embracing him, saying he doesn't get enough credit. That was one of her opening lines, but also really saying she knows how to work with Congress and be realistic. And it is important to note that Senator Sanders is not considered somebody who can get a lot done in the Senate. He has done the same sort of filibuster that Ted Cruz has done to oppose the president on increasing or the continuing the Bush tax cuts back in 2011. So these are all issues that I think the American people are looking for somebody to put them in context for them. And it all comes back to how they feel about the economy, right? A lot of political prognosticators will tell you that when people go to the ballot box, it's about do they feel like they're better off than they were, and will they go with that same party that's in power? So when you think about the giant stock market losses and the fact that people are seeing their retirement portfolios slowly be chipped away with big losses this year, that's a dangerous position for the Democrats.
A lot of people have been feeling bad about the economy for a long time, maybe a deeper response than we've seen before. Maybe that's what Trump and Sanders mean out of New Hampshire. And what actually gets done on the foreign policy front, John Kerry talking this week about ceasefire and emergency food into Syria. Maybe here he was with the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov in Munich yesterday.
We believe we have made progress on both the humanitarian front and the cessation of hostilities front. And these two fronts, this progress, has the potential, fully implemented, fully followed through on, to be able to change the daily lives of the Syrian people.
Jack Beatty, I've kind of given up on knowing what to think of that kind of talk from John Kerry. If it's true, hallelujah, the suffering has been just horrible. But all we've seen is bombs raining down on Aleppo, suffering, people fleeing out there in the many tens of thousands. And this kind of talk about ceasefire, really? I mean, the Russians have just put the pedal to the metal there for Assad. Is this just happy talk? Are the Russians playing him? Is this real?
Well, that's the risk. The administration's argument seems to be, and it goes back really to the beginning of the Russian intervention. Remember, John Kerry was pretty sanguine about it. He seemed to think that they could lean on Assad, that they could work out a political, transition.
Well, they've just gone to bat for him.
That's right. That's what they did instead. But now the thought would be, well, they've given Assad some leverage. He's now got Aleppo back, or virtually, and this food aid, a lot of it is going to go into his cities that are besieged. So actually, that's going to help his regime, too. So the point is, perhaps this is a moment when Russia has some leverage if they want to use it. And if they only use it in a humanitarian direction, well, that's something. That's a real moral gain. If they want to use it in terms of a political transition, hallelujah. We don't know.
Fareed in Lexington, Massachusetts. Fareed, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Great show. I'm calling about Syria. I'm from Syria. I'm from Damascus. I was there until I was in my 20s, and I came here. I've been here for 45 years, and I've been following both the foreign policy of this country and the world and the Western world. And the Syrian
Medina. Take us to your question, Farid. Our time grows short, my friend.
Yes, yes. What I'm saying is that many people in Syria have welcomed the Russian intervention and thought that was late in coming, because the solution for this is for Assad to get back in power enough to fight his war better than anybody else. He has feet on the ground.
Farid, let us pick it up right there. Our time's so short. Cristina Bellantoni, will that be a rallying cry of anybody on the campaign trail? Hillary, who, you know, or anybody else, it's time to get with the Russians and Assad and turn back the hands of time?
Well, anything is possible. You actually didn't hear much discussion about it in the debate, which was surprising because foreign policy is one of Clinton's strong suits. But if we can predict anything, it's that the Republicans will be criticizing any Obama foreign policy out on the campaign trail, particularly as you see them go through South Carolina. And I think that this does, you know, inflame a whole lot of questions I expect to hear in the Saturday debate between those Republicans.
41 days in the bird sanctuary in Oregon. Here was the last holdout, David Frost, in a phone call with negotiators Thursday morning before he agreed to come out of the refuge.
Now I'm making my stand. This is my stand, guys, folks, ladies. So this is where you come to a point in life where it's liberty or death.
Jack, was something resolved there at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge?
Well, nobody else was killed. That's important. This was
one death. Yep.
Yes. Yes. This was a very disturbed young man, as his rambling monologue there goes on to show.
He was under a little bit of pressure.
He was under a good deal of pressure. He wanted to really say, I want another cookie and then I'll come out. But you know, what it does sort of light up is, and it's hard for Easterners to get this, the resentment in the West of the role, the centrality, just the size of the federal government in their lives. It owns a lot of that land, and just naturally that has periodically created resentment, and this is one example of it, an extreme one.
On the other hand, you've got people saying, well, you know, the time of just extraction is behind us now. The real value lies elsewhere. Maybe that's an old battle. Maybe not. We will see. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Sudeep Reddy, Deputy Global Economics Editor at The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Washington. Sudeep, terrific to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Cristina Bellantoni, Assistant Managing Editor of Politics at the Los Angeles Times, with us from California. Cristina, thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. And Jack, great as always to have you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, read or get a link to the LA Times interview with President Obama there, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm there at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.